I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about what we refer to as the quarry camps. Two camps, Flossenbürg and Mauthausen, that were unlike the other concentration camps of the late 1930s, in that they were structurally different, and in terms of the economic activities they were meant to pursue. They also were fundamentally unlike camps such as Dachau or Sachsenhausen. The third camp that I'm going to talk about today is Oranienburg. And the thing that unites all these three camps was Hitler's architectural vision for Germany during the late 1930s and during the early war years. And the reason why these camps existed was really as a result of that kind of architectural and aesthetic and cultural vision, that Hitler viewed himself as the great rebuilder, or the great builder of German cities, and he had vast plans, not just for Berlin, but for up to 20 cities in Germany, places such as Munich and Nuremberg, to be razed to the ground almost and rebuilt in stone and with phenomenal quantities of bricks. And that's why Flossenbürg and Oranienburg, well, Flossenbürg and Mauthausen were known as the quarry camps. They were there to use slave labour to quarry stone. And Oranienburg was a brick-making camp, or became a brick-making camp, despite massive SS incompetence, as we shall find out in the failure to make any bricks successfully at all before the war. So today, again, we're looking at Nicholas Vachmann's excellent book, KL, History of the Nazi Camps. And he writes, sometime during the second half of March 1938, Oswald Pohl, and Pohl was the economic overseer of the camp network, and Theodor Eich, former commandant of Dachau and later commandant of the entire camp system, set off on a business trip across the south of the German Reich, accompanied by an entourage of SS experts. They were scouting locations for KL suitable for planned economic ventures. Around March the 24th, the group travelled through the impoverished and inhospitable landscape of eastern Bavaria, near the Czechoslovakian border, with its dense forests and barren soil. What had brought them to this remote corner of Germany, sometimes jokingly referred to as the Bavarian Siberia, were the quarries around the villages of Flossenbürg, which had been operated there since the 19th century. Thanks to the building mania in the Third Reich, production had recently increased, and Pohl and Eich agreed that there was an opportunity for the SS to join in. Later, the SS search party crossed what had until recently been the Austrian border, heading towards Linz, and to expect the nearby granite quarries around Mauthausen. Here too, Pohl and Eich found what they wanted and lost no time. Within days of their visits, the establishment of two new camps were underway. So, the first camp to open was Flossenbürg, and it started to receive its first prisoners in May 1938. And the camp began to grow gradually over the next few months throughout 1938 and into 1939. The SS leadership looked upon the development of Flossenbürg very favourably. They thought it was a very important project. And Himmler visited himself on the 16th of May. And Pohl and Eich visited slightly later and even spent some holiday time there, sending back holiday pictures to Himmler. In Mauthausen, the first prisoners came in August 1938, and the initial group of guards there forced the prisoners to make quarters in the quarry itself, and later they moved them to a permanent compound that sat on a hill above the quarry. It was the labour at Flossenbürg and Mauthausen that marked both camps out as being some of the most feared destinations for prisoners. Prisoners very quickly learned what life in the quarries did to their fellow inmates across the camp system, and were terrified about being sent. The architecture of both camps was fundamentally different to that of Dachau, Sachsenhausen or Buchenwald. The camps had large granite watchtowers, the towers at Mauthausen joining up with huge granite walls that enclosed much of the compound. Obviously, stone is a cheap commodity at the camp, doesn't have to be moved particularly far, and as ever, the inmates are responsible for building their own systems of imprisonment. Flossenbürg and Mauthausen are smaller initially than other camps for men, in terms of prisoner numbers at the very least, but by the end of 1938, Flossenbürg held 1,475 inmates, Mauthausen 994. This is pretty small stuff. Sachsenhausen, Buchenwald and Dachau all held above 8,000 inmates. But the ambitious plans that the SS had to enlarge the two camps initially show little effect, but it would be the Second World War that would see mass influxes of prisoners into the two camps to see them rival other aspects of the camp system. The makeup of Flossenbürg and Mauthausen, the makeup of the prisoner population, is quite different as well. In 1938, the Camp SS launched the biggest and most ambitious attempt to gather the same prisoners in the same locations, reserving the two camps mainly for social outsiders and alleged professional criminals. So mainly political prisoners weren't there initially. Mass transports of prisoners who were selected from the other big three camps began to flow towards Mauthausen and Flossenbürg when the camps opened. So initially, the Mauthausen and Flossenbürg select criminal prisoners from those two camps as opposed to becoming dumping grounds for those who were new to the camp system, new prisoners. This meant that before the war, nearly all prisoners at Mauthausen wore the Green Triangle, and this was a group, they were closely matched by the number of asocials, those were who considered work shy or lazy or unable to function within the Third Reich, people with addictions or social dysfunction. And a great many gypsies and Sinti and Roma were incorporated among this number. The very fact that people lived transient lifestyles, they move around, was considered to be asocial itself. 100 alleged criminals died in Flossenbürg and Mauthausen even before the war broke out. And this was more than the other three camps put together. Why professional criminals then? Why were criminals sent to the two quarry camps? Forced labour in those quarries was regarded as particularly punishing, and many Nazi officials believed that the worst prisoners deserved the hardest labour, that there was some kind of trade-off there. When senior Nazi SS figures suggested in the late 30s that concentration camp prisoners should be sent to lethal radium mines, granite has radium isotopes within it in the form of radium gas, Himmler's response was enthusiastic, saying that the most serious criminals should be made available for this work. However, although this plan never came to anything, the SS later adopted the principle of sending the unredeemable criminal, the recidivist and the asocial inmates, to the chaos with the worst working conditions, because ultimately there was nothing that the Reich could gain from these people. It was seen by the SS that they had no purpose other than to be a nuisance when they were set free, and so the idea really was that they weren't to be set free, and that they would end their days in the camp system. In a speech in 1937, he described asocial and criminal prisoners as dangerous and violent-born, who'd spent much of their lives behind bars and it was all they really knew. Himmler referred to them as murderers and robbers and sex offenders. He said, "It would be an insult to animals to call such a person..." He referred to a 72-year-old man who committed 63 indecent assaults. "It would be an insult to animals to call such a person an animal, because animals don't behave that way." The quarry camps in the spring of 1938 were filled with the prisoners who seemed to be most deserving of suffering. However, most of the prisoners who turned up in the camps bore very little kind of resemblance to the sorts of folk devils that Himmler was summoning in this sort of speech. They were mainly small-time thieves and burglars, often from social backgrounds, and often they were people who had been arrested for begging. So they were fairly small-time prisoners who were sent to a torment almost beyond the ability of many of us to imagine. The first months in the quarry camps were especially hard. Nicholas Voschmann writes, "As in other new camps, prisoners had to build the infrastructure, exhausting and perilous work, aggravated by the primitive living conditions in the makeshift compounds. Meanwhile, hundreds of other inmates were already toiling in the quarries. Work began early in Flossenbürg, where three quarries were operational at the end of 1938. In Mauthausen, too, labour in three different quarries began in 1938. Soon the largest such complex..."
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Controlled by the SS. Prisoners had to carry out the most arduous jobs, preparing the ground with pickaxes and drills and hauling huge granite blocks. Adolf Gussack, an Austrian gypsy who came to Mauthausen on March 21st, 1939, on a large prisoner transport from Dachau, recalled later the first days in the Weiner Graben, one of the quarries. In the quarry, we had to carry heavy stones. With them on our backs, we had to climb the 180 steps towards the compound. The SS beat us. As a result, there often was somebody pushing. Everybody wanted to escape the blows. If anyone fell down, he was finished off by a bullet to the back of the neck. Now, the third camp I want to talk about today is Oranienburg. Oranienburg and the brickworks that were created there tell a fascinating tale about incompetence and the idea of brutal and yet ruthlessly efficient Nazi methods of economic organisation are really kind of thrown into the sort of the myths that they are by this particular story. There is, in 1938, in the summer of 1938, on the banks of a canal, about a mile from Sachsenhausen, the SS began to build what would have been the world's largest brick factory, with a annual output, a planned annual output of 150 million bricks, around 10 times more than large factories normally produced. The project, which was probably initiated by Albert Speer, was heavily promoted by the SS as a showcase for its economic prowess. Himmler is always trying to find ways of expanding the SS empire into other areas of economic or military life, and he is trying to constantly find ways of kind of replacing aspects of German life altogether with the functioning of the SS. So he wanted to really to kind of make inroads into manufacturing and heavy industry. Determined to prove its ability, this is Waschmann writing, determined to prove its ability to harness modern technology for the Nazi regime, the SS opted for the most costly and cutting-edge equipment, so-called dry press machines, which promised speed and efficiency. SS managers staked their reputation on successful outcomes. Heinrich Himmler apparently attended the ceremonial laying of the foundation stone on July the 6th, 1938, and remained keenly interested in the progress at the building site. So, of course, the entire site would have rested on forced labour. The SS used civilian contractors, some civilian contractors for the brickworks, but the bulk of the labour force came from Sachsenhausen. In pre-war years, a daily average of 1,500 to 2,000 prisoners were used, and having access to this amount of free labour obviously makes the SS a serious economic player. When the SS, when the prisoners had managed to clear the trees on the site, which was the largest, and the prisoners were the largest labour detail on any site at all, they began building. They excavated a dock. They moved the ground and levelled it, and constructed the main factory, and another labour squad worked on a railway line for transporting clay from a few miles away to the plant. The contrast between the plant's high-tech design and the primitive conditions on the construction site could hardly have been greater. The most strenuous labour was performed by prisoners with very basic tools, or in some cases no tools at all, having to work, dig with their hands. Large inmates carried piles of sand in their uniforms, which were worn back to front, so the backs of the jackets formed a kind of an apron. The prisoners moved large amounts of earth in rickety wooden stretchers or shifted sacks of cement on their shoulders. Prisoners climbed scaffolds and poured down cement, barely clinging to wooden clogs. So as a result of all this manual labour, there was a huge numbers of deaths on the site. Severed limbs, crushed bones and the like. SS terror was abundant as factories were scarce. The latrine, for example, was no more than a beam across a ditch, writes Waschmann. And SS guards like to push exhausted inmates into the pools of excrement below. Inmates feared the brickworks as a particularly destructive labour detail. So some mornings they faced a long march to the building site, and they would have been beaten along the way. And they would have staggered back to the compound in the evening, carrying the sick, the wounded, and the dead. If you ever go to Auschwitz, in the Auschwitz I prison barracks, there are pictures, depictions by Polish prisoners of what it looked like to be returning to camp at the end of the day, carrying those who had died on the job that day. The SS managers had agreed very, very tight, impossibly tight schedules for the creation of their flagship plant, and then we came under stress when it turned out that it couldn't be fulfilled. So they used immense amounts of violence in order to force the prisoners to work faster. Countless prisoners, writes Foschman, perished on the desolate Oranienburg's building site, succumbing to exhaustion, accidents and abuse. There were some suicides too, and the worst period came in the winter of 1938-39, when a renewed SS push to complete the project coincided with a cold snap in the Berlin region. Prisoners worked in thin uniforms without gloves as temperatures fell below freezing for almost 3 months. Often the soup they ate for lunch would turn to ice. Between December 1938 and March 1939, at least 429 Sachsenhausen prisoners died at the brickworks and elsewhere in the camp, more than any other KL during the period. The great majority of the dead were called so-called asocials, who made up the largest prisoner group at Oranienburg building site, and who faced special harassment by the SS and the camp capos. However, the entire project was an enormous failure. The brickworks were one of the kind of the Nazi sort of equivalents of huge Soviet and later Maoist pointless exercises in state project building. In May 1939, during the first trial run, the plant already a month behind schedule, the SS watched in disbelief as the bricks that left the kilns crumbled and fell apart. Because they had no understanding of the industrial processes required to make bricks, they had made a number of fundamental errors. So they had never bothered to check whether the local clay was suitable for the dry press production, and it was not. So this meant that the new factory, which had cost so many lives, never produced a single brick. The disaster at Oranienburg showed that SS incompetence was rife when it came to essentially anything other than violent and brutal repression. So when the SS have tried its hand to industrial processes, it was essentially incapable of doing so. Why? Perhaps because the entire process was based on what this sort of notions of working towards the Führer, of trying to use willpower and forced labour to create impossible projects, ignoring the fundamental scientific and engineering realities behind them. The reaction of Oswald Pohl was very telling. He did not scale back SS ambitions, but pressed ahead with brick production at Oranienburg, no matter what. He was fully imbued with this sort of Nazi idea of the triumph of the will, the idea that willpower can overcome anything. Well, of course, willpower and slave labour can overcome anything if you don't really worry about how many slaves you kill. So in a desperate bid to save himself in the summer of 1939, Oswald Pohl quickly, in an attempt to keep Himmler in the dark about the scale of the disaster, began to search for scapegoats. He dismissed the private building contractor and the SS chief executive, and handed control of the plant to administrators, Nazi bureaucrats who had some better understanding industrially of how these sorts of projects actually work. The result was that the prisoners were forced to tear down everything that they'd just built, demolish the kilns, and rip out machines and destroy the concrete foundations, and go through a huge rebuilding process to use to create a new, more reliable wet press system of brick making. Of course, it's cost more lives. And in 1940, after the production process was started again, the plant produced, in its total lifespan, about 3 million bricks. If you imagine that a standard factory produces something like about like 15 million in 1 year, it was a kind of a dismal conclusion to a bloody and violent episode in the camp system. Anyway, I'm going to finish there. Thanks very much to for listening. If you can visit our Patreon page, I'll post the link below this podcast. We do rely on a tiny little trickle of advertising revenue, but the kindness and the largesse of our patrons. So if you can help out, that's greatly appreciated. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.